Today is the 19th of July, 2008. We have in studio again Paul Minotta, continuing our series on the critique of Christopher Hitchens' book, Why God Is Not Great. This is part 7 and 8, which covers chapters 5 and 6.
Coming to you live from our studios in Southern California, Real Christianity in the Real World, The Narrow Mind.
Okay, we're going to have to start that over. Somebody just coughed into the microphone. Was that you?
Yeah. I didn't. I thought you couldn't hear it.
The mic is on, so. So, yeah.
But I mean with the music playing or something.
You can hear it right over the top of the music.
I don't know. I like it. That's human touch for the intro music.
Yeah, but the problem is
I spent all this money on these little foot switches. They're called cough drops.
See that?
Yeah.
You like how that works? All right, we're going to start the music over.
Coming to you live from our studios in Southern California, Real Christianity in the Real World, The Narrow Mind.
I hope you've learned something tonight, because you've got a lot of learning to do here.
I've learned once again that the atheist can't account for morality. That's what I've learned.
Oh, are you kidding?
Do you sin as a Christian?
Please know that there are different degrees of sin. Worry.
Oh,
is a
okay.
Sin. I do.
You're
worry.
A Roman Catholic.
I'm answering your question. I'm answering.
Okay, so obviously you didn't get all the Roman Catholicism out of your system when you claimed to have been born again.
And now our host, Gene Cook Jr.
Good morning, everyone, and welcome to another edition of The Narrow Mind. We have with us in studio again Mr. Paul Minotta and my co-host, Jonathan Goundry. We're going to continue our discussion on the critique of Christopher Hitchens' book. And it's quite interesting that this morning I received an email from a friend of mine, Pastor Dustin Seegers, in Greensboro, North Carolina. This is from the WorldNet Daily website with today's date of July 19th, 2008. The title is, Hitchens Takes on New Atheist Gospel to Masses, or Takes New Atheist Gospel to Masses, Squares Off with Christian Thinker at Friday Night Fight in Las Vegas, written by Art Moore. It was billed in jest as a Friday night fight in the city known for epic bouts, but a Libertarian Conference's headliner debate last night featuring God Is Not Great author Christopher Hitchens offered much more, reflecting the growing visibility and muscle of a new breed of atheists spreading their message with evangelical fervor. The debate was one of eight at this year's Freedom Fest, which describes itself as the trade show for liberty and the world's largest gathering of free minds. With his trademark wicked wit, the British-born journalist Hitchens, now an American citizen, took on political writer and Hoover Institute scholar Dinesh D'Souza, a devout Catholic, on the subject, War, Terrorism, and Geopolitical Crisis. Is religion the solution or the problem? It's a long title for a debate. The article goes on to say, as relevant as the topic was to former Trotskyite,
whoever that is,
who passionately backs the Iraq war and recently subjected himself to waterboarding, it became clear that Hitchens, and the audience for that matter, wanted to get to the central issue. Are the claims of Christianity true or not? Hitchens himself laid out the parameters from the start. Quote, today we only have time to discuss one thing. Does this stuff, even if it's all made up, does it at least make people behave better? And then it's quite interesting because the very next thing that you see is an ad here in the middle of the page entitled Plagued by Man Boobs and Excess Belly Fat.
Is somebody having a joke?
No, I don't think it's a joke. I think that this is just smart advertising. Because if you're going to be a fan of Hitchens, as we've already seen in the first six parts to this series, you're going to be mentally lazy. And so there's a good chance that you're also going to be spiritually lazy. And that's why you're going to look, or rather physically lazy. And that's why you might run the risk of looking like Christopher Hitchens himself. So I think that this is just clever, smart advertising, targeted advertising. But I digress. The article goes on to say, but after an opening exchange with D'Souza over examples of people who do bad things in the name of religions, Hitchens was in high form. I don't know what that means.
Yeah.
Does that mean he drank a couple of martinis before? Arguing that most of the witnesses to the resurrection of Jesus Christ were deluded, illiterate, hysterical women. Where does he get this stuff?
I don't know, man.
Hysterical women.
Yeah,
most of the witnesses.
I wonder if he's read the Bible.
I don't think he has.
I need to ask him one time.
Yet for all of his bombast and admitted scorn for Christianity, the audience of about 1,000 who deemed D'Souza the winner, narrowly, in a hand count afterward, clearly warmed to the Cambridge-educated Hitchens, whose self-depreciation and deft, deadpan humor proved irresistible, prompting frequent outbursts of laughter and applause. Barely containing his mirth after hearing D'Souza's argument, he began with, "That was terrible, Dinesh." Robert Spencer, who earlier in the day debated a Middle East studies professor on the topic of Islam, peaceful or violent, was among the impressed. "I'm not an atheist, but Hitchens would almost make me one," Spencer, a Catholic, told WND. Interesting. Hitchens, whose 2007 bestseller bears the subtitle, How Religion Poisons Everything, has teamed up over the past 2 years with an informal group of prominent new atheists who prefer to call themselves anti-theists.
Hmm.
Along with Hitchens, the Four Horsemen are biologist Richard Dawkins and philosophers Daniel Dennett and Sam Harris. Hitchens told WND after the debate, his purpose is simple. "I do it because I think the essential argument that underlies all other arguments is one between belief in the supernatural and repudiation of that," he said. "It cuts across all left-right libertarian statist arguments." D'Souza, author of the New York Times bestseller, What's So Great About Christianity, told WND he is engaging Hitchens because, quote, "the new atheists have been getting a free ride for a couple of years. With their tremendous mainstream media exposure, their arguments go unchallenged," he said. They will say things like Christianity is responsible for people who want a theocracy in America, or radical Muslims over there are very similar to the Christians over here. Everyone just goes, yeah, I guess so. D'Souza said that's why it's very important to intellectually contest this, both to embolden Christians who feel a little bit besieged, but also to reduce the arrogance of the atheist. "I see it as empowering the believers, flummoxing the unbelievers, and appealing to the man on the fence," he said. "These are my three goals." If you scroll down a little bit, there's the poster. Freedom Fest, Friday Night Fights. You've got a picture of Hitchens.
Two very intimidating looking gentlemen there.
Yeah. At Bally's in Las Vegas on July 10th through the 12th. I just want to pull out a couple of quotes here down at the bottom. Opening the debate, Hitchens insisted, quote, "I don't think there's any evidence to make us believe religion makes us better," pointing to Zimbabwe dictator Robert Mugabe's Catholic faith, the embrace of Russian Orthodoxy by hardliner Vladimir Putin, and the threat from Iran's theocratic Muslim regime. "When will it happen that an apocalyptic regime will get a nuclear weapon?" he asked. "It has almost certainly already occurred. The parties of God will confront us where they make us live at their pleasure." He goes on to say, "Until we can get rid of this wish for tyranny in our own heads, we stand the chance of emancipating ourselves from the hell and terror of now," Hitchens asked. D'Souza said he wanted to take on the new atheism and its strong point, acknowledging the argument has an element of truth. "We hear crocodile tears about the crimes of religion," he said. "But the Crusades were 1,000 years ago. The Inquisition 500 years ago, which killed a relatively small number of people, about 2,000 over a period of 250 years," he argued. See, this is one of the problems with debating a Roman Catholic. He's going to say, yeah, I know, but after all, it wasn't that many people. By contrast, not only the crimes of Christianity, but of Islam, pale in comparison to the crimes of communism, D'Souza said, noting even that the smaller operators, such as Pol Pot, never mind Stalin or Mao, managed to kill 2 million people. If religion must be blamed for crimes, D'Souza said, then so should atheism. I don't know about you, Paul, but that doesn't sound like a very strong argument, line of argumentation.
Well, I mean, there's maybe some other things that should have been said.
Right,
but I made those same arguments because the point was Hitchens's theory can't account for all the data. So when I bring in non-religious groups or anti-religious groups that murdered people or that caused war, Hitchens's theory can't account for that. So he should drop it. That's what I've argued. He needs a broader theory. The Christian worldview can account for all the injustice on both ends, the religious and non-religious, due to original sin.
Right, but when you're right in saying that. But when you have a limited amount of time in a debate format, if this is all you have, all you've done is say you're just as bad as we are. See, in our series here, we're not doing that. We're addressing the issue and showing that Hitchens' own critique against Christianity he's being a hypocrite because he doesn't apply it to his own worldview. But in addition to that, we're also going to show, and we've been explaining, why Christopher Hitchens really can't be consistent living out his atheistic worldview. For example, just the ad here, the ad that I pointed out here, plagued by man boobs and excess belly fat. See, the Christian worldview can account for that.
Yeah. Why is that? Why is that attack upon human dignity?
Yeah. Because of the fall.
Because of the fall.
Right. Adam didn't have man boobs and excess belly fat. That came as a result of the fall. So all of, Christians are people that claim to be Christians killing each other. Non-Christians killing each other. We can account for this within our Christian worldview, because the Bible tells us that man's heart is wicked to the core, and the Bible also tells us beware, because not everybody that says that they are a believer are actually believers. So there are many false professors. And so, but does atheism allow for this? Well, he's an atheist, but he's not really an atheist, and he's not representing atheists. These dictators and these leaders that commit these atrocities, they're not really atheists, because if they were atheists, they wouldn't kill each other. Actually, they're living out consistently with their atheism.
Mm-hmm. It's just a no true Scotsman fallacy.
Right.
Mm-hmm.
Well, I'm not sure if I should agree with that.
Why?
What is a no true Scotsman fallacy?
Well, it goes like this. Someone says, Angus, all true Scotsmen eat haggis. And Angus says, well, William Wallace, he doesn't eat haggis.
Yeah.
And so, in response, they say, well, William Wallace then isn't a true Scotsman.
It's the time you finish defining what a true Scotsman is.
Yeah, we obviously know that William Wallace, if anyone's a true Scotsman, William Wallace is, right?
Mm-hmm.
Braveheart. And so, with Hitchens, you can say, well, no atheist would do anything like that.
Right.
And then you point to someone who did, and they go, well, he's not an atheist.
Yeah. Right. He's an occult. He's a cult.
And he did do that with North Korea. He said, I was listening to him the other day talk about North Korea and how that, really, if you look at that government there, rather, it really is based upon a religion than it is atheism. So he seems to just appeal to that.
He actually mentions that somewhere in this article. I saw that. But for the sake of time, we're going to move on now to actually the book itself, which is the main reason why we're here.
Mm-hmm.
We got a late start this morning. I decided to update my... Oh, there it is right there. Hitchens insisted North Korea and other communist regimes are built on a personality cult and are essentially theocracies. So,
yeah, well, that's not a religion. I mean, now we're just going to stretch religion to personality right. cults, and so basically, what it is just is there's no more sense to the term religion.
Right.
You've
pretty much
everything.
Yeah.
So.
You've stripped
a personality cult just means that he wanted people to worship him, basically. Right, and he's just a human. He's an evolved human, and
yeah. And I've seen some atheists talk about
a god or anything.
We could call the Four Horsemen a personality cult.
Yeah, we could.
Yeah, you could. I mean, at that point, what defines a non-cult? What type of organized group could then be qualified as being acceptable within his atheistic definitions?
And in Hitchens' book, The Portable Atheist, where he has a bunch of his friends write, he takes their articles and includes it in the book, he has Daniel Dennett, one of the other new atheists, write the chapter on defining religion. And the definition of religion there that Dennett uses is that it includes some sort of belief in the supernatural. So why would he include that as he was seemingly endorsing Dennett's definition of religion, yet when he's going to call, North Korea, a religion, but they don't worship the supernatural.
Right, or they don't have a supernatural element to their belief system.
So that was another problem I've been mentioning, is he doesn't define anything, and that lets him get away with a lot.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
All right, Paul, so what do we have from the book, chapters 5 and 6?
Chapter 5 is on is titled The Metaphysical Claims of Religion Are False, and 6 is on Design Arguments. And chapter 5, I mean, I have some stuff to say, but I have to stretch a lot and pull some stuff out to get it, because it's not a good...
Have to really dig for it.
It's not. There's not even an argument there, and it's disappointing because the chapter has this bold title, The Metaphysical Claims of Religion Are False. And so when I first was reading the book for the first time, and I came to that chapter, I was excited. I finally was going to meet with something with substance, and it just was a big letdown. So, but I mean, I have some stuff
Would you like me to read some excerpts from this particular passage?
Sure. I just highlighted what I take to be the core of what Hitchens that would count as an argument in that chapter. And I've just highlighted all that for Jonathan to read. And then when he's done, I will lay out the jumbled mass that Jonathan reads into a more coherent argument.
Okay, let's see. Okay, I'm going to read from page 64 to begin with. We read, "One must state it plainly. Religion comes from the period of human prehistory where nobody, not even the mighty Democritus, who concluded that all matter was made from atoms, had the smallest idea of what was going on." Okay, I'm going to turn over to page 70. And he continues, "It has taken us several hundred years since Occam to come to the realization that when we gaze up at the stars, we very often are seeing light from distant bodies that have long since ceased to exist." Further down the page he says, "However, and crucially, we can now do this while dropping, or even, if you insist, retaining the idea of a god. But in either case, the theory works without that assumption. You can believe in a divine mover if you choose, but it makes no difference at all, and belief amongst astronomers and physicists have become private and fairly rare. It was actually Occam who prepared our minds for this unwelcome conclusion. He devised a principle of economy popularly known as Occam's razor, which relied for its effect on disposing of unnecessary assumptions and accepting the first sufficient explanation of cause. Do not multiply entities beyond necessity." Continue on page 71, he says, "Creda quia absurdum, as the Church Father Tullian put it, either disarmingly or annoyingly according to your taste, I believe it because it's absurd. It is impossible to quarrel seriously with such a view. If one must have faith in order to believe something or believe in something, then the likelihood of that something having any truth or value is considerably diminished. The harder work of inquiry proof and demonstration is infinitely more rewarding and has confronted us with findings far more miraculous and transcendent than any theology. Actually, the leap of faith, to give this, to give it the memorable name that Søren Kierkegaard bestowed upon it, is an imposture. As he himself pointed out, it is not a leap that can be made once and for all. It is a leap that has to go on and on being performed in spite of mounting evidence to the contrary. This effort is actually too much for the human mind and leads to delusions and manias. Religion understands perfectly well that the leap is subject to sharply diminishing returns, which is why it often doesn't in fact rely on faith at all, but instead corrupts faith and insults reason by offering evidence and pointing to confected proofs.
Okay, and that basically amounts to the whole case again, which shows that the metaphysical claims of religion are false, and that's it. Instead of taking what Jonathan read and just interacting with that explicitly, I'm going to try to formalize Hitchens' argument to make it sound a little bit more powerful than what we read, and I'm going to try to get at what he's...
Wait a minute, whose side are you on?
What he's trying to argue.
Why are you helping Hitchens?
Well, because that's...
He's
my neighbor.
That's right. And, you know, there's some atheists out there who could, as you've already observed, Paul, better articulate their position. But within this cluster of paragraphs that I've just read, there is some semblance of an argument, would you say?
Yeah, you have to draw it out, though. The argument that I'm gonna present makes it will make it more clear. So you guys can listen to this and see if it sounds a little bit better. Okay, I basically have his argument as this: religious beliefs come from a time when mankind was stupid and explained everything by saying God did it. Now we can explain events without having to say God did it. Thus, we have no need for positing God to explain anything, per Occam's razor. The only way we can believe in a God anymore, then, is by faith. If you need faith to believe in something, then the likelihood that that something having any truth value is diminished. Therefore, the likelihood that the statement God exists has truth value is diminished. If you don't want the truth value of your belief to be diminished, then you need evidence for that belief. If you have evidence for a belief, then faith is pointless. Therefore, if you don't want the truth value of your belief to be diminished, then your need for faith is pointless. But without faith, there's no excuse to believe in God, since we can explain everything without Him. Therefore, either Christians have the truth value of their beliefs diminished, or they lose the only excuse they have to believe in God. But if the truth value of your belief is diminished, or the only excuse you have to believe in something is removed, then you should drop that belief. Therefore, Christians should drop their metaphysical beliefs in a God and His actions in the world.
Yeah, that's pretty devastating.
Yeah.
Yeah, what do we do with that?
Well, I take that to be basically what he's getting at, what he's arguing.
I think that's fair.
And it flows more coherently than his book and than his prose in the book there. And with the additional of some suppressed premises, it can easily be seen to be a valid argument. But the additional premises would be just as dubious, if not more so, than what I listed in the argument that I read. So, showing that some of these premises to be false, then the argument would be shown to be unsound. And by showing some of them to be questionable, the argument loses any persuasive value. Because we have no reason, you know, to believe some of them, so it's not going to persuade any Christian. And if Hitchens is just trying to preach to the atheist choir and have them agree with him, well, then he's not really doing his job of destroying religion and ending, you know, theocracies and terrorists, because the religious people won't listen to him, so he needs to have a persuasive case. And then also by showing some of them to violate preconditions of the argument's own intelligibility, then the argument refutes itself. And that's what I'm going to do. I'm going to show those those where the argument goes wrong in those ways. It has some key presuppositions, and each of them affect the soundness of the argument and its demand on rational assent, how it can pull us or compel us to ascend to it. It has some presuppositions that we're going to look at and then deny. The first one, or argue against, the first one is the God of the gaps, the God as a hypothesis assumption. The second one, the God of the gaps assumption. The third one, Occam's razor. Fourth, the nature of explanation, of scientific explanation, I should say. Five, the faith as belief contrary or in spite of, or in the face of contrary evidence or known facts assumption. And six, what we can call the evidentialist constraint. I had some stuff I was going to say, but I think we're doing the Hitchens article. We're a little bit behind time. I'll just briefly comment. I was going to take a little digression on one of the comments he made in this chapter, that all causes need a cause, and then who designed a designer. And he says that no Christian has been able to answer that argument, and that's just a devastating maneuver.
Oh, really?
And so I had some stuff I was going to say on that, but basically, I mean, it's almost intuitive why it's wrong. And, not all causes need a cause. And obviously, even without knowing who designed, let's say I said, I don't know who designed the designer. And let's say even, just for argument's sake, let's say even God did need a designer. That wouldn't refute design arguments, right? If I went to a murder scene and there was a victim laying on the ground with a knife plunged into his chest and footprints running away from the crime, I could come and say, oh, well, this was an intelligently orchestrated act that caused this person to die. It wasn't just, mere chance, an earthquake didn't happen and he fell down and a knife fell on his chest, and then the earthquake changed just by chance at some weird angles and it formed footprints in the ground. We wouldn't do that. We would attribute it to an intelligent designer, right? And would Hitchens come in there and say, no, that's not a good theory, because who designed that designer, right? Or if I were to look at Mount Rushmore and I said, look, this was sculpted, could Hitchens come to me and say, but you haven't answered anything unless you can tell me who sculpted the sculptor?
Mm-hmm.
Okay, so basically that claim, who designed the designer, has no force at all, even if I couldn't answer it. It doesn't show that what we're pointing to that has design doesn't have it, because we can't explain who designed the designer. And then, obviously, which I shouldn't have to mention, is God didn't have a designer. If you're eternal and
self-sufficient
and necessary, you don't have a designer. And also, that view is that the view that God would need a designer views reality as all a bunch of parts and mechanisms working together, and so God must be more complex than us, like a big giant machine, and so he needs a designer. But if you take the view that God's simple and, some basic Christian assumptions, then his claim is just something that's ridiculous. But I'm going to skip all the more detailed comments I had on that and move on.
I think that was good, because even though you're only giving us a nutshell version, I think it's enough to digest. Oftentimes, as Christians, we fall for this. Or not we, but some Christians fall for this when they're talking to their unbelieving friend or neighbor, and that person says, okay, but who made God?
Yeah, answer that.
And then we spend a bunch of time explaining that God is self-sufficient, that he's eternal, which he is, and they say, see, that's just a problem. Well, that's a problem maybe for you to understand that God is eternal and self-sufficient, but like you said, that's not a problem with the reality that God created the world that we live in.
Right.
That's not a critique against that.
Right.
So,
and
very
good point. The other point that I was going to make as well, as far as all causes need a cause, Roger Penrose, one of the premier mathematical physicists of our time, has a massive book called The Road to Reality. And in that book, he argues that he regards mathematical patterns that are exemplified in nature as concrete property instances of abstract mathematical exemplars, something like a Platonic realm.
Right.
Now, those forms or those exemplars are causing these mathematical patterns in the world. But no one in their right mind would say that those are caused. So those things caused something, yet that cause didn't need a cause. So I just take assumptions that Hitchens would be bound to agree with and show that his view doesn't even follow. Mm-hmm. And the view that all causes need a cause necessarily commits yourself either to an infinite regress into the universe or saying it was eternal, which obviously goes against a lot of even secular scientists, what they believe, and there's other arguments against that.
Yeah. It's like 2 plus 2 equaling 4 doesn't necessarily have to be extended in space or have causality to be the case.
Right. But when we do see it, when we see instances of that, we could say that form has caused something in the world to come about. Mm-hmm. The addition of, or the sum of 4 now.
Mm-hmm. So if I see 2 water bottles over there and 2 water bottles over there, those combined water bottles cause the equation of 4, right? Is that what you're saying?
Yeah, I mean, that's not necessarily what Penrose is saying. He's talking about that there's these patterns, you know, when you look at the structure of atoms and stuff like that, there's these mathematical patterns, and those are caused. But your point's still fine as far as it goes. It's not exactly what Penrose is, but is saying. But yeah, mathematical. There's at least arguments out there that would say that the abstract mathematical, you know, forms, even though we wouldn't agree necessarily with the existence of some Platonic realm, mm-hmm. but those forms cause things, patterns in the world, mathematical patterns. But those exemplars don't need a cause themselves. So not all causes need a cause.
Right.
But just jumping into the 6 points I mentioned earlier regarding the some key presuppositions of his argument, I'll go over them real fast. The first one is that in critiques like this, he's treating God as a scientific hypothesis in order to explain the data. So theists posit God as some sort of a hypothesis, scientific hypothesis, to explain data in the world. You know, so why did the apple fall from the tree? Well, because God did it. That's the explanation. So now I have a scientific explanation to explain why that happened. Atheists like J.L. Mackey make much the same point, and he even makes claims almost identical to Hitchens, right down to the use of Laplace's claim that when it comes to God, we have no need for that hypothesis. So I wonder if he's borrowing heavily from Mackey and just not giving him support. But anyways, Hitchens supposes that there's some body of facts that both the believer and the unbeliever agree on. And then to explain their occurrence, the believer postulates a God to explain the data, and the unbeliever postulates some other hypothesis to explain the data. If the unbeliever's hypothesis can account for the agreed-upon data, then there's simply no need for the God hypothesis. As far as Christian theology goes, Hitchens offers no evidence that God is or ever was treated as something like a scientific hypothesis invoked to explain data. He offers no serious analysis of the historical situation in the way belief in God functions in the life of the believer, whether it's a scientific hypothesis or not. He simply asserts that this is what's going on. And so he gives the careful and cautious reader absolutely no reason to take his claim seriously. The Bible frequently attributes natural causes or natural occurrences to natural causes. The Bible doesn't claim that people don't know how babies are born or form the hypothesis that God must have done it and he's inside there pushing the baby out and all that kind of stuff. Moreover, if belief in God is basic, and it's warranted in light of something like a model like Alvin Plantinga, say, then belief in God isn't the scientific hypothesis invoked to explain data, only to be jettisoned in favor of some more economical theory, any more than belief in other minds, the senses, induction, and the existence of a past are hypotheses invoked to explain data, and we'll just jettison those if a more economical theory comes along. The belief in other minds isn't some scientific hypothesis to explain other people's actions and, you know, how they talk to me and stuff like that. So I don't buy his assumption that we treat God as a scientific hypothesis to explain data. That's a key assumption of his argument. Number two, Hitchens is assuming that believers are held to some kind of God of the gaps view of reality. Okay, but it's not even clear what he has in mind here, since, again, no detailed scientific and historical survey of the relevant data is offered. He doesn't go and show how believers are treating their God talk and how they're using God in everyday life. He doesn't provide any of that. And it's not even clear what he thinks this objection amounts to, the God of the gaps, God of the gaps objection amounts to, once we analyze it. A basic form of the fallacy instanced in the God of the gaps reasoning goes like this. Since I don't know how P happened, therefore God did it. Okay, but are there any serious instances of this argument in history? I mean, I hear this all the time from atheists, but when I read back through, you know, Christian apologists or theologians from hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of years ago, no one's reasoning like this.
Yeah, I've heard Richard Dawkins speak along these lines as well, that you can't just magically come up with this God to explain the gap, to explain the inexplicable.
Right.
Yeah.
Yeah, and but when they do that, they don't show where believers do that.
Mm-hmm.
They don't show where any of us have done that. So he's attacking just some, right. You know, make-believe version of theism. Now, the argument that I mentioned earlier, that God did it, it's basically a form of what's known in the textbooks as an argument from ignorance. But when we look to this argument to see if we can say, okay, well, let's see what the theist is doing here that's so naughty, and we'll look to the argument from ignorance and see really what's going on here. Well, there's really not much in the textbooks analyzing the argument from ignorance. Basically, the argument from ignorance goes like this. The examples they show in the books. There is no proof that P is false, therefore P is true. But even examples like that in history, regardless of Christianity or not, are few and far between. Hardly anyone that I've ever ran across or seen in books argues there's no proof that P is true, therefore P is false. I don't really see that. So, logician Douglas Walton points out that we hardly find any examples of people reasoning in the above format. That argument would look like this. If there were good reason to believe that if P were true or false, then we should be able to find evidence of it. The lack of evidence provides good reason, via modus tollens, for concluding that P is false. So what Douglas Walton is basically saying is, there's really no fallacy going on here a lot. Really what people are doing when you see instances of this is they're using this broader modus tollens type reasoning that goes like this. If I would expect, if this were true, that we would see evidence of it. We do not see evidence of it, therefore I don't expect that it's true. So that can't be fallacious, because that's modus tollens. You can't have a valid argument that's fallacious. So, once analyzed, there's no problem with the logical structure, but only a question then of whether we should accept the conditional claim, right? Which the conditional claim is if this were true, we would see evidence. We don't see evidence, therefore it's not true. The conditional claim is, if this were true, then we should expect evidence. Well, that's where we should question whether there's any merit in the conditional claim. And so I would argue that most instances of people who complain about God of the gaps reasoning, we have a case of someone who does not reason on ignorance of how natural causes operate. They don't say, well, I don't know how that works. I don't know why that apple fell down, and so God did it. But actually they reason on the basis that we know enough about the cause and the natural world to say God did it. So it's not, I wouldn't even call it ignorance, an argument from ignorance. It's that we know about the way the world works to say, look, God must have done that. So, to the extent that Hitchens has an undeveloped notion of the God of the gaps fallacy, his claim is simply a myth. That I don't see this in history. And to the extent that he would want to try to be more sophisticated about it, I would say I would have no clue what he's trying to object to. He'd have to make this a lot more explicit.
Mm-hmm.
As far as Occam's razor goes, Hitchens fails with this, with the use of Occam's razor at numerous levels. So first off, of course, it wasn't Occam who developed it, who gave us the principle. It was mentioned by Aristotle, Augustine, and Aquinas. But remember earlier in the chapter what Jonathan read, he said, these religious principles begin in a period of history when men were just stupid.
Right.
Well, so did Occam's razor develop in that period then. So the principle of it, I mean, it wasn't called Occam, obviously, but the principle of Occam's razor developed then. So he's using a principle developed by primitive, stupid, ancient, superstitious minds. So I don't know why he thinks he can, you know, use principles developed by stupid ancient people when it comes to Occam's razor. But when it comes to metaphysical claims of theism, that's just false because it was developed by stupid people.
And yet in the first century, you can read Greek philosophers who didn't believe in the supernatural.
Right. Well, that's in there as well. And he mentions Democritus, too, and which is an early form of materialism, mm-hmm. but he has no problem in believing materialism. So he's, more of his hypocrisy. But appeal to Occam's razor doesn't entail anything about which theory is true or false. It can't tell us that. At best, it tells us which theories to prefer. Okay, so you guys know what you're doing in Occam's razor, right? What you have going on is, let's say I have this little candy out, sitting out, and it gets eaten, and I could come up and say, well, mm-hmm. I believe my theory is it was eaten by one ant, mm-hmm. and one ant could do all the work. He could eat this little piece of candy that got left out, and someone else comes along and says, no, it was done by two ants. Well, Occam's razor would say, well, why the extra ant? When one ant could have eaten the candy. One ant can explain it, so why even... It's useless to posit the extra ant. Okay, so it just would tell us which theory to prefer, right? It would tell me, I prefer the one ant theory.
Yeah, because with one ant, you still have the sufficiency with the one ant. The two ant becomes unnecessary.
Right. Okay,
right?
Just on Occam's razor, but we'll
yes.
see that even gets problematic because it makes... It only works in a certain area, and I'll explain why. But with Occam's razor, simplicity, telling us which theory to prefer, there's plenty of secular non-Christian, philosophers of science who opt for beauty over simplicity. So they would say, no, you need to go with the more beautiful theory. And they don't even hold to the simplicity thing. So there's a lot of stuff going on here, even within Hitchens' own team. Is why we should expect or take his view of science over another's. Other non-Christian philosophers of science have pointed out that it's difficult to remove subjectivity from how we decide which theory is simpler. And of course, the simpler theory only works if what is to be explained is in fact simple. You don't invoke the theory when you know the answer also. Okay, so now I'll go back to those ants. Let's say I watched it. I watched two ants eat it. Well, in that case, I know the answer. So you can't come to me and go, no, one ant could have done the job, so you don't need those two ants. So you only invoke Occam's razor then when you don't know the answer. So you're ignorant, right, about the answer, and so you have two theories and you come up with and say, well, let's explain this data, and you have two theories. And the simpler one should get preferred, if we even grant them all that. Well, that only works if you don't know the answer. So it's an argument from ignorance. And Hitchens is assuming then that Christians don't know the answer, right? He's begging the question then. If we know the answer, then this Occam's razor doesn't even come into play.
Yeah.
So basically, he would be begging the question. On this matter, without, because he's not showing that Christianity is false in there. He's applying the razor, which assumes that we can't know or that we don't know. So you can't argue that the metaphysical claims of religion are false based upon this. You only could, even giving him a bunch of other premises, you only could if you said, well, we don't know if God exists or the metaphysical claims of religion are true. So now let's use Occam's razor. So it's just one giant question begging. So he can't claim that the metaphysical claims of religion are false based on a mere appeal to Occam's razor. And it should also be pointed out that Occam's razor doesn't do much good if it leaves what we would call furniture, ontological furniture of the world, unexplained. And so I would argue that Hitchens' worldview, his nice, simple worldview, leaves we would have to dispose of mental states, norms, purpose at all, mathematical entities, abstracta, not to mention being able to explain how life originated or the fine-tuned nature of our universe. So simply put, naturalism just can't account for all that needs to be accounted for. So the razor's no good. If you're going to slice away all these things that we need, mental entities and ethics, then, you know, you've went too far with your razor. And then also, again, Occam's razor speaks to scientific hypotheses, and I've just already argued that we don't treat God as a scientific hypothesis. So he's trying to sneak in this whole... it's this whole assumption, this whole fake world that he weaves together in this chapter with all these hidden premises that Christians are running around treating God like he's a scientific hypothesis and that they reason God of the in the God of the gaps way and all this stuff. And he builds that into the chapter to get you kind of nodding in agreement with him. But all of these assumptions that are vital to his chapter are just bogus. Then he talks about explanation. Well, we don't have any need for that hypothesis. We can explain the data with this. Well, there's problems with explanation. The nature of scientific explanation is hotly debated. Hitchens shows no familiarity with it. There are more types of explanation that can be given. For example, covering law models, realist causal models, contextualist or pragmatic models. Hitchens would need to explain which theory he has in mind and show how it's relevant that theism doesn't offer an explanation along those lines. Some philosophers of science believe that there is no way to characterize scientific explanation. Since there are several types of answers scientists give to why questions generated from the puzzles that they're considering, there are some are quantifiable, some are not. Some appeal to a singular phenomenon, like the Big Bang or abiogenesis, for example. Some repeatable phenomena, not singular. Some referring to unobserved entities, some not, so on and so forth. So not only you know, does Hitchens seems to have no clue of what he's talking about when he's getting into this explanation business, he would also need to define science for us in this chapter so that we can have necessary and sufficient conditions to know what counts as scientific and non-scientific on his worldview. But even as non-Christian atheistic philosophers of science point out, that's very hard to do, to try to give a necessary and sufficient conditions of science. And I basically see that we're running out of time, but that's enough to critique his explanation position. And I would also say that the use of God as an explanation is the explanation of an agent. It's agent explanation, not mechanistic explanation like he's thinking. So he could have consulted guys like Richard Swinburne, J.P. Moreland, William Lane Craig to see the use of person explanations, which totally undercuts his mechanistic one. His notion of faith he operates with, obviously as Christians, I don't really even need to go into that because he says it's belief in the absence of or contrary to evidence. He doesn't even bother to deal with anyone. This topic is discussed in virtually every philosophy of religion book. Hitchens could have, been a critical thinker here, been a scholar, and he could have cited, say, Paul Helm's book, Faith with Reason, pages 1 through 20. Or why not interact with Plantinga's definition and exposition of faith and warranted Christian belief, pages 241 through 289. Why not deal with contemporary standards such as Moreland and Craig's Philosophical Foundations for a Christian Worldview, pages 5 through 17 and 17 through 18. Indeed, a standard college textbook for introductory epistemology classes, Routledge's Epistemology, A Contemporary Introduction to the Theory of Knowledge by Robert Audi, and pages 285 to 286, he says that faith can certainly be rational. There's no mention of any of this, and Hitchens just takes his own mischaracterized definition to move along in his argument. No care to interact with the other side. And then his dealing with Kierkegaard is simply abysmal. Kierkegaard, he could have done some study on Kierkegaard even to find out that Kierkegaard doesn't hold the position that he tried to portray. He just held to the caricature. But, for example, you could go to the Cambridge Companion to Kierkegaard, and you could have read the article companion on faith, and you could see that it's contradictory to what Hitchens portrays Kierkegaard. Or if Hitchens didn't want to buy the book, or he didn't have enough attention span to read that chapter, he could have moused on over to the respected Stanford Encyclopedia of Philosophy that's online, clicked on the Phidism article, and he would have read all about Kierkegaard. He would have read this. Although he relentlessly criticized what he perceived as the overweening ambitions of academic philosophy and an unwarranted reliance on foundationalist tendencies in theology, Kierkegaard held that faith and reason are not mutually incompatible. Okay, so we have the scholarly world on the one hand, the guys who know and study this stuff, and then Hitchens and his mischaracterizations on the other. And this is just amateur hour at Hitchens' house. So on faith, he's obviously in error. And then the last point that undercuts his entire argument, the belief that you need evidence in order to rationally hold a belief. Well, then what about that belief itself, right? Yeah. Either Hitchens has evidence for it or he doesn't. If he does, then he has a new belief. The new belief in that evidence supports his old belief. But for that belief to be rational, then he would need more evidence. And once he gives it, then he has a new belief, that he is given this evidence to support his theory. Well, that's a new belief that he needs evidence for, and that can go on for infinity. So if he doesn't have evidence for this constraint of his, then he believes in the absence of evidence and is every bit as irrational as the theist is. And that was my shortened version of everything I was going to say, because we're running low here.
All right, what we're going to do is we're going to take a quick break, and when we come back, we're going to have the second part of the show, which will be part 8 in our series. So stay tuned with us. We'll be back in just a moment with more on Christopher Hitchens' Why God Is Not Great.